I virtually never give a title. In fact, when I'm asked to, people come up and say, what's your title? And I have to really work and go back and think, what should I entitle this? But this one today is fairly easy. It's called The Privileged Ones, if you are into putting down titles. As David camped in the mountains of Moab, and he gazed across the Jordan Valley, he could see something that was spectacular to him, and that was the mountain that overlooked Jerusalem. And more significantly than that was the temple. There was no place on earth that David would have rather have been at that time. And the closest he could come to describing the craving he felt for being in God's presence was thirst, this life-saving sensation of thirst. He was in the desert, he was fleeing from Saul, and so he knew that sensation intimately. There's a lot of references in his writings and his psalms to water, and you can imagine why. But when you visit such arid places, the Middle East, we've gone a lot out to Utah and Colorado and Arizona, New Mexico and Wyoming and so forth, and Southern California, different places, desert, and it comes with a warning to be really be careful. In fact, when you go to the Grand Canyon, there's some people who have died. A lot of people have died just in those environs, that's for sure. But they warn you. They don't say you have 5 liters of blood, but you do have 5 liters of blood, by and large, on average. And when it's hot, and it's like where David was and in Utah and Arizona and some of these places, you lose about 1.5 liters of fluid an hour. We know that, right? Under the best of conditions, you last about 3 days. Some have lasted long, but on average about 3 days before you succumb to dehydration and death. And David was in such a place where that was always a threat, always a danger. We know a lot about thirst because of a discovery some decades ago of a highly specialized part of the brain. And it's called the lamina terminalis. And this area, along with, there's another area, the hypothalamus too, monitors our thirst, our capacity to respond appropriately to thirst. We've learned the impact of losing fluids and what happens in the body. Minerals, salts begin to concentrate, and if the cells don't adapt very quickly, if the body in total does not adapt very quickly, then you're going to be in trouble. These cells, which utilize all kinds of nutrients, and they lubricate, and they dump off waste, they have to be helped almost immediately when you start going into a dehydrating type of a process. The heart rate begins to go up, the blood pressure rises, the kidneys begin to stop dumping fluid and stop dumping even waste. They concentrate waste, you stop sweating, you do all kinds of things. But the one thing we notice is thirst. That's the only indicator, perhaps. Now, there's dizziness and other things that follow, and some terrible things, but initially, that's our warning. What makes the lamina terminalis so amazing is that it not only is inside the brain, blood-brain barrier, and it's next to the parts of the brain, ventricles, where there's a lot of fluid, and so it can monitor the brain for dehydration, but it also has cells that are outside the blood-brain barrier, which is very unique for an organ. And so it can monitor what's happening in the body, which happens a little more quickly. So it can begin to respond and begin to send out these warnings a little ahead of time over the cells that are in with the blood-brain barrier or inside that barrier. As you sip and as you swallow, because of the lamina terminalis, even before you've absorbed any water whatsoever, the body begins to respond, and the lamina terminalis will turn off your desire for more water. You haven't absorbed one bit of water into your brain, or around your body even for that matter. It hasn't gotten to the small intestine, through the liver and all that. Essentially, the body tells you when you've had enough. So it's warning you first that you need water, and then it stops you before you become waterlogged and create a whole cascade of other problems. Well, David gazed wistfully across this valley, the Jordan Valley, and he was inspired to write one of his most beautiful psalms. It's my wife's favorite, one of her favorite, if not her favorite, song in our songbook, Psalm 42, beautiful poetry. And we have some people to thank for that beautiful poetry. If you read, I finished a couple books on the Bible and on the people who began to translate it, Tyndale and these people that translated it into English. It's a remarkable story. And it's because of people like Tyndale that we have this beautiful King James English. And this is in the King James. He wrote in Psalms 42, verse 1, as a deer pants, and I put it, for streams of water or for brooks, so my soul pants for you, O God. And in verse 2, my soul thirsts for God, for the living God. Now, if you go down and to the Message Bible, I'm not a fan of the Message Bible for any number of reasons. This is how it says it in the Message Bible. A white-tailed deer drinks from the creek. I want to drink God. Deep draughts of God. I'm thirsty for God. Alive. I wonder. Well, it just goes. It gets worse, actually. But it's the beautiful English of the King James. After reading this, I went back and started enjoying the King James more, even though sometimes I'll be quoting from or using different versions today. May not always be that clear in that regard. In Hebrews 11, verse 6, there's a promise. God will reward those who earnestly seek, and the word for seek is crave, those who seek him or who crave him. We have a promise there that he will satisfy that. David, in fact, wrote later that God had satisfied his soul. And we're going to see how that satisfaction takes place. The Jewish world teaches us that there is a way to satisfy our thirsty souls. There are a number of ways, but this is one system that I came across. That what a neat system. It's called PRDS. It's both a Hebrew word and it's also an acronym that represents four levels of understanding, which was indicated or talked about in the, not the four levels, but the levels of understanding, this desire to understand more. The letters PRDS are ironically the consonants of paradise. PRDS, take out the vowels and you have PRDS. Barclay, one of my favorite commentators, points out, when a man has penetrated into these four different meanings for the scriptures, he reaches the joy of paradise. This is pretty neat. More particularly, the word pardes, P-A-R-D-E-S, you put in several vowels, refers to a park or a garden, mainly an Edenic type, the Garden of Eden. It's such a beautiful phraseology to think that the very place where God designed for man to be in his presence, to have the perfect relationship with him, was the Garden of Eden. That's what pardes is kind of describing. How do we return to that? How do we bring that back into our lives? Adam and Eve violated that, right? And they were blocked. They could never get back into that perfect setting for a relationship with God. So there are things around that keep us, right, that tend to stifle that desire if we're not careful. Advertisers all the time are telling us how we can go to a paradise, an island. And basically what they're saying is you can, if you're in the right place, you can recapture the magic, right, of that relationship of your mate or your family or whatever, whomever you're attempting to return to this original beauty of a relationship. Pardes appears three times. I don't really have time to go through each of them, but it only appears three times in the Aramaic New Testament, and each time it's translated as paradise. It indicates this return to this Edenic type of relationship with Christ. One example is Christ on the cross. Today I tell you, you will be with me in paradise. That's pardes. Saying one day, you're not going to be a thief on a cross. You're going to be in my presence. PRDS, pardes, is an outline for recapturing that Edenic type relationship. The author of Hebrews, in Hebrews 10, he quotes Jeremiah 31, verse 33. And he's paying particular attention to God's original intent, which was not an old covenant. It was a new covenant. It was that man from the very beginning was to have these words imprinted on his heart and in his mind. It was supposed to be this attachment to God that was intellectual, that was emotional. And that's at the heart and core of pardes. Number one, I'll go through each of these. There are four of them, PRDS. The first one is peshat. That's P, P-E-S-H-A-T. It's the first level of understanding. And in Hebrews, it just simply means peshat, P-E-S-H-A-T, P-E-S-H-A-T, means plain, it means simple. It means the most obvious things that you glean, the literal meaning from a verse. It's the first thing we look for. It's reading the Bible through from beginning to end and not necessarily stopping along the way, but it doesn't disregard that either. The sequence of history, the stories, the analogies, all the wonderful things, the lessons. It's like a reporter. I was a journalist major, and we were taught who, what, where, when, why, and how. And that's what we're looking for. We're looking for these essentials. Foundational truths. It's really our introduction to foundational truths. But it doesn't have to remain our introduction, because every time you read through it, you pick up something more, right? Peshat is ritual. It's a daily routine. It's within our reach, which is what makes it so beautiful. In what was called a morning psalm, David writes in Psalm 61 or 63, verse 1, early, and this is what we're talking about with Peshat, early will I seek you, my soul thirsts for you, my flesh longs for you in a dry and thirsty land. We are in a dry and thirsty land, aren't we? I'm a little dry and thirsty too. I didn't plan on this, but I'll get the top off. I'll take a drink. In a dry and thirsty land, he says, imagine David. Look how lucky we are. Within an arm's length, driving up here, we just sipped on water the whole time. So amazing. Psalm 63, verse 1, he says, early will I seek you in this dry and thirsty land. In verse 6, he says, on my bed, I will remember you and think of you through the watches of the night. There are three watches. So he says, at the beginning and the end of every day, I'm going to think about you. You're going to be on my mind. I'm going to seek you in this dry and thirsty land. And in verse 5, he says, my soul will be satisfied. It feeds on itself, which is the wonder, the beauty of it. In Genesis 15, we have a story. We have a history. It's Peshat. It's plain. It's simple reporting. Abraham, it reminds God, you've given me these promises, but look, you know, I don't have anybody that to bear children, you know. I have no heirs except for this servant, he said. And he said, God tells him, look up in the sky. We know the story. You can't even count the stars, can you? If you could count them, that's going to be your lineage. That's your offspring. In the next chapter in verse 6, in Genesis 16, I only meant to just go over this to illustrate Peshat, is an account of Sarah, Abram's wife, trying to take things into her own hands. She realizes the same thing he does. She's barren. She can't have children. It's very straightforward. She has to figure out how to work this out. If it's God's will, she's going to work it out. She's going to figure out how to take care of it. So she takes their slave, Hagar, and Abram has a child by Hagar, and all it does is fuel this jealousy and this rage and this anger in Hagar, or not in Hagar, well, Hagar too, but certainly in Sarah, and so she's banished out into the desert. It's a very poignant story with some obvious lessons, but it doesn't go into it. I mean, they're there for the taking, right? No need for any deeper understanding at that point. There's an amazing promise to those who recognize God's voice, which we heard about in the sermonette. It's a beautiful, in Revelation 3, verse 20, and I read these off kind of when I go through to save time. You can note them, and I'll read them to you. You can look them up if you want at this time. But Peshat is essential to recognizing that voice, and we get this beautiful promise in Revelation 3, verse 20. Here I am, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice, so there's more than just knocking. There's something. He may be speaking through the door and saying, hey, is anybody home? If you open that door, he gives this promise, I'll come in and I'll eat with that person and they with me. He promises a meal in which you will be satisfied. Your soul will be nourished. It's a beautiful phraseology. Author David Teams, who wrote one of these books on William Tyndale, really had read one of his books and thought, wow, I've got to read more about this guy. The translator, he was the one who took it from Greek and Hebrew into English, the first, and died on the, he's an incredible man to read about, and died on as a result. They strangled him, and then they burned him to death. That's what happened to people who who encourage people to read the Bible. You know, we were in a Goodwill this weekend, and there are places, there's a stack of Bibles. There's 15 Bibles. Other secondhand stores we go to. We love to go to such things. Telling on my wife here. But nonetheless, Bibles galore, right? He said this of understanding the Bible, of reading the Bible. He said he was convinced that if you misperceive God at the most primary level, your entire perceptions lean out of center, out of plumb. Peshat is known as the architecture of the church. It's the very foundation from where we get our sound doctrines, we get our fundamental truths. Number two is Remez. Remez, we heard about in a sermon I'll mention a little bit later, some years ago. How many of you ever heard the sermon on Remez? Some of you? Yeah, a number of you? Okay. So I'm not going to redo that, but it's an incredible sermon. If you've not heard it, it's online, probably in a number of different forms. But it's a Hebrew word that means hinted at. It suggests something more than the literal meaning. There's more kind of reading between the lines. It uses lines. It uses allegories and metaphors. And Teams, again, in his biography of Tyndale, wrote this. He said, Tyndale was swept up by metaphor, by the delicate art of resemblance, where one image allows you to visualize another. 90% of the King James Version came from the Tyndale Bible, from this wonderful man who gave his life, fled from his home, never to return to England until he died. The examples of metaphor, the metaphors would be the kingdom of heaven is, and these are almost every one of these is a Tyndale translation, a king, I'm paraphrasing, a mustard seed, a man who planted good seed, leaven, treasure in a field, a merchant who was searching for fine pearls. Metaphors are said to be these messages, these treasures, and they are treasures that are found below the surface. They're there waiting for us to find them. Every Hebrew word, on average, some have far more than this, has on average 15 English meanings. So it's exhaustive, right? To find, inexhaustible really, to begin to see the word, one word representing so much richness in our own English language. Gives us this range that is incredible. But Remez, for those of you who have heard the sermon, is much more than metaphor. It requires this high level of familiarity. You have to know the scriptures for you to be able to understand Remez at any great level. Jesus, the rabbis, the great teachers, they use this as a teaching technique. But the only reason they could do it was because their audience had a great understanding of the Bible. My son Nathaniel walks through the kitchen, and everybody in our house does this at some time or another, and starts singing a song. You hear a song, you start singing it, and we know within a few words that we know the song, and we can join in or we just listen as he sings out of tune. No, I'm kidding. So we can be, it's almost contagious, right? If it's a song you really like. But it's part of our shared life. It's part of the things that we've done together, our shared culture. And we remember them because it's been repetitively experienced together, right? The same is true of our culture, of our heritage. I could say things like 67 years ago, and you know where that was given, don't you? Gettysburg, we know that. I pledge, we know. If I start to say I pledge, you can pledge all kinds of things. But if I say I pledge, and you know it's having to do with culture, you know you can fill in. You say the rest of it. We hold these truths to be self-evident. I have a dream. If I say I have a dream, you don't think, well, what was it? What did you dream about? If in this context, you know I'm talking about Martin Luther King, right? These are part of our shared culture and our experience. But just as we have children and we share music with them, we share culture with them, we also want there to be a spiritual heritage. And this was so important to the Jews of Jesus' day. Josephus wrote about that regarding the education of children. Quote, we take most pains of all with the instruction of children. He called it the most important affair of our whole life. You can see why people homeschool, because they don't want to leave it to a school that is constantly changing. And it won't even tell you about your children, about your culture. I went over every book with Natalie from the time she was a history book, from the time she was in about third or fourth grade. Through every one of them, not to screen us, because I love history and I enjoyed it with her, and she wasn't that enchanted by history. I had to give her, try to get her interested, poke her and probe her just a little bit. He said, we've taken most pains. For the ancient Jewish culture, that education began between 5 and 7. They began to memorize the entire Old Testament. So the people Jesus was talking to, if they were educated much at all, they knew the entire Old Testament by heart. In his sermon on Remez, the one I was talking about, Scott Ashley gives this beautiful sermon on Remez, and he uses, he called it a word game that Jesus used on a number of occasions, where he'd give a part of the verse and they would give the rest of the verse. They knew it. He used it wonderfully to teach and to really teach lessons. Sometimes that had a sharp edge to them, you'll see here in a moment. But he could only do that because these people had this formidable, this incredible knowledge of the Bible. One of my favorites is an example he used, and I've used it in a sermon before. It was in the closing days of Jesus' ministry, kind of the time we're getting ready, we're approaching here with the days of unleavened bread, Passover and all that. And it takes place in Matthew 21. He's already chased all these frauds out of the temple, right? They've been using the temple for extortion and for gain, the money changers. And then he goes and he heals the lame and the blind and the sick, right? And now the children have begun to chant because they've seen what they called these wonderful things he had done. And they're singing, Hosanna to the Son of David. The idea of children praising Jesus just created this jealousy, this rage, this anger, this hate of the chief priests and the elders, right? These people who knew the Bible backwards and forwards, they knew the law. And Jesus is going to take advantage of that in just a moment. And they're watching this drama play out. And Jesus knows, he sees them, that it's unmistakable. They're angry with him. They're ready to grab him and choke him by his neck or worse. It says in verse 15 of Matthew 21, they were moved with indignation. And Jesus' response is a classic remez. He quotes Psalm 8, verse 2. And in verse 16 of Matthew 21, he quotes, he says, from the lips, out of the mouth of children and infants, you have ordained praise and strength. If no adult praises, then the children will do so. Kind of like the rocks. If you don't praise, he can raise up these rocks to do that, right? He will be praised. The children, they're going to read. So, that's what Jesus quoted. If no adult praises God, he will use children. That seems pretty innocuous, right? But it's what he didn't say that is incredible, that is extraordinary, and it hit them right where it counts. He said, the rest of it, they, the children, silence your God's enemies who were taking revenge. He's saying, these people with their praises are silencing the very enemies of God. Who are those people? It's you. They knew it. It was unmistakable. It was pointed at them. And we know it hit home because in Mark's translation of this, Mark 11 verse 18, we're given their response. And this is what he said. He wrote, they began looking for a way to kill him. Children praising, and he quotes that psalm about children praising, big deal. They knew it meant they were the enemies. These were the people he was chasing out of the temple. There's a spectacular and more recent historic example. I have some historians here. I know Andy and I share this love of history. And this is a neat piece of history. I got this through Chuck Colson's book, The Body, some years ago, and it's always made me, I just love this story. And it was in England, and it was only, this remez only worked because the English-speaking people at that time had an incredible understanding of the Bible. It took place in May of 1940, and you'll recall the story. In May of 1940, the Germans have the British troops, the English and the French troops there. They've got them against the sea, right? The English Channel, and somebody said it. already, you'll know. But it's such a 500,000 French and British troops. They're on the French side of the English Channel. And Edmund Ironside, the chief of the Imperial General Staff, suggested to a colleague, this is the end of the British Empire. So the church has called a national day of prayer, and British leaders had, from the king on down, responded. Now, the thing that's so amazing is that the troops that were chasing them up against Channel left, or they withdrew. And the reason they did, they thought that the Air Force could come through the German Air Force and just destroy them. They'd be sitting ducks there. So to say we do have a way of escape, by the way, they had to send a message. It was a very cryptic message. And this is all it said. It was a three-word message. And if not, that's it. The English people knew what that meant, which is so incredible, both the leaders and the countrymen. It was enough to stir them into action. And that morning, in response to that cryptic message, there was an order given to evacuate Dunkirk. Evacuate now. Everybody with a boat available got in their boat, went across the English Channel, and rescued 336,000 men. It's the greatest lift of that type, ferrying people to escape to safety, called the Miracle of Dunkirk. Well, where does that remez come from? A lot of you recognize it. Wonderful remez. It's from the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They're standing before King Nebuchadnezzar, and it's recorded in Daniel 3, verse 17 through 18. And they say this to they were getting ready to be thrown into these fires. They would surely die. Our God is able to save us. We need saved, that's for sure. And if not, we will remain faithful to him anyway. It's an incredible cryptic message that they understood because they understood the Bible. Number three, that was remez. Number three is the D, P-R-D-S, and D is drash, D-R-A-S-H. And in Hebrew, drash means mystery. It literally means search. It comes from threshing wheat or threshing grain, where you separate the grain from the chaff, the essential from the non-essential, from the useless. But what it implies is just a deeper, more thorough investigative study, a search for something deeper. I've started getting different commentaries that I love. They're incredible. They change the way you read it so extraordinarily. There are a few things we may differ on, but they're overwhelmed by this immense amount. Matthew Henry, I love. There's other ones that I could share with you, but it changed the way I started reading the Bible. It gave me such a fuller, even I have a patient that's talking about Leviticus. Reading it, I go, look, read Matthew Henry. It'll make Leviticus come alive. And that's no easy task in parts of Leviticus, as you know, talking about the law, right? The details of the law. This more thorough. Paul, the Apostle Paul, was great at doing this, giving the secret meaning, a hidden meaning. The Bible doesn't disappoint us. It gives us these scriptures that are meant to be investigated. And drash penetrates deeper. It goes into metaphors, not just metaphors, even deeper than that, into parables. In the prophecy of Psalm 78, verse 2, Jesus spoke in parables. And he's fulfilling that prophecy. I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter things kept secret from the foundation of the world. Wouldn't you want to know what that is? Secrets from the foundation of the world? Parables are said to be these physical curtains that hide something. But they're not rock-solid doors, they're curtains, you know. They're meant to be moved as pushed aside, and behind them are the mysteries of God. But what was the secret that was saved, that was being kept from them, from the foundation of the world? That this mystery of God, the secret was Jesus. He's saying, I'm revealing to you through these parables, the secret's been kept, so listen up. These are incredible parables that you need to understand what is going on here. And they'd be critical if you want to teach other people these mysteries. These men came to know God so much, they were willing, they not only taught, they were willing to give their lives up to do so, right? In Mark 4, Jesus presents to his disciples the parable of the sower. It's a critically important parable about how the church receives the gospel. How everyone in you, the opening prayer was beautiful. about how we need different things and help us to take what is uniquely meant for us, right? But anyway, that's this parable of the sower. And in verse 10, I won't go through the sower. We know he's sowing wheat, and some of it comes up and some of it doesn't. Some of it blows away. Some of it comes up for a short while and then withers. And in verse 10, the disciples ask him to explain. And he tells them in verse 11, the secret of the kingdom of God has been given to you. They're probably thinking, what? What is it? In verse 13, Jesus followed that up with, don't you understand this parable? There's probably a little frustration there. How then will you understand any parable? If you don't understand that there are different ways you can treat this word, and there's four basic ways you can treat this word. You can treat this word with indifference, right? You're indifferent, you're careless. It really is irrelevant. In a dry and dusty land, it can be irrelevant to most people, right? Saying that's one way. You can treat it irreverently. You can be hypocritical about it. You can appear to be a Christian, and that's important. We found in our own office, the people who come in and say, by the way, I'm a good Christian. I say, hey, take cash. They're parading. They use that as their calling card. We've seen that. We have been doing business now for years, a couple decades, and we found that to be almost, we haven't heard much of that lately, but for a while we heard that a lot. There's others that are easily separated from it. They hear the word, they grasp it, they grab hold of it, and they think, this is me right on. And then they have a trial, or maybe they become successful. I have to appreciate, I tell my kids, oh, if you can be thankful while you're successful, while you're in the light, be grateful. It'll make the darkness so much easier. But all of those are unacceptable, Jesus is saying. There's only one right response to the gospel, and that's that it converts us, that it changes our heart in such a way that we have this unquenchable thirst that can't really quite be satisfied. We want more and more deeper applications. I'm not talking about things necessarily. They're so deep. You can get off, you can get derailed so easily. I have a patient that comes to see me. He, 10 years ago, or so when I met him, maybe more, maybe 15 years ago, I treated his mother-in-law, maybe 20. But at any rate, we talk about Matthew Henry. He goes, it's too many words. Too many words. But we at least talked about commentaries, his favorite. Every year, he comes back a couple times a year, brings his wife. He's gotten loopier and loopier. To the point now, he's talking about space aliens and, you know, how we were seated on this earth and that the Old Testament is a little bit, he's not so sure about the Old Testament now. And we'll get into that in just a moment, that getting off on these fringes, you know. Paul loved to teach at this level. He called them the unsearchable riches of Jesus Christ. Those, they were so deep. And he counted it a privilege to introduce the Gentiles to that message. Naturalist John Muir, who I love in a special way, he's known as the father of the national parks, and we love the national parks, the Green family. He memorized 3/4 of the Old Testament and all of the New Testament. Now, if that wasn't enough, it was by the time he was 11. His dad was a Methodist, very serious, very hard-nosed kind of a Methodist. But John Muir memorizing all of that didn't really prick his soul, except that as he became older, there's some conflict about that. But basically, he just saw God in nature. It didn't point him to Christ. It didn't point him to anything deeper. So the fact that you're familiar, the fact that you've read through, doesn't mean that it penetrates, that it gets into the heart. Philip had been with Jesus more than 3 years when that's the bulk of his ministry, right? When Jesus asked him, have I been with you so long and you still don't know me, Philip? You've been with me all this time and you don't know me. Philip had seen enough in those 3 years, and Jesus had been with him enough in those 3 years to say, Philip, if you have seen me, you have seen God. And you've seen me. There's no two ways about that. So it's possible that we read and we study and we go through the same things each time, which we were talking about in the sermonette. I'm not a preacher. I'm a teacher, you know. So when I read through this, I think, wow, this is so neat to me that I need to plumb the depths. And Paul, I love Paul for that reason. If you ever read, there's a wonderful book about Paul. It's just called Paul. Can't think of the author. It's a wonderful book. And it's somebody in our headquarters. In fact, a young guy is going to interview the author. I can't think of the author's name. But anyway, it'll change how you look at the Old Testament. And you and I, we've all been looking at the Old Testament our whole Christian life, right? Those who come to know Jesus at this deeper level, this hidden level, Matthew Henry called the privileged ones. The privileged ones. Those are the people that Jesus promises will never leave thirsty. The privileged ones. Drash is a transition from Exodus 20 to the Sermon on the Mount. It's from law to grace. We don't disregard one. There's just a greater expansion, right? From rote behavior to doing what I alluded to just a moment ago, what the writer of Hebrews called a piercing of the thoughts, a piercing of the attitudes of the heart. That's what he's saying is that's drash. That's where we're moving into this deeper level that penetrates the heart. In Proverbs 25, verse 2, it tells us this. While it is the glory of God to conceal a thing, it is the honor of kings. The honor of kings. The king's privilege to search and to find. Why did a king search and find? Was it just for himself? If he were a selfish king, but it's for his kingdom. It could warn him of things that were damaging and disastrous. It could also very much link him into things that would help his kingdom prosper. Very important that this king, this honor of kings is to search and to find, but it's also the honor of the privileged ones, right? To search and to find. My parents, when they heard Mr. Armstrong for the first time, had been searching. I remember going to a couple of churches as a young boy, about 5 years old, and they heard Mr. Armstrong. The neighbor came down, actually came down and told Mom and Dad about this wonderful experience. She was getting the plain truth and had heard this wonderful message. And all of a sudden, my parents began to understand the Sabbath. They began to understand the holy days, began to understand clean and unclean meats, all these things that had been. Christmas and Easter, they'd always been a little skeptical of any rate. All of a sudden, mysteries began to unfold and it became clear what they meant. That little sheet that was in front of it began to be pushed aside because they desired it. They wanted to know. They were searching, which is really important. One of the defining attributes of the universe is the capacity for discovery. The moon has just enough light that it doesn't block us from discovering other things at night. The planets are lined up perfectly so that we can see, we can do things and see things in space that otherwise, this is out of my bailiwick. I usually don't speak and have an engineer who, you know, with such aplomb here. But these are things that are meant to be, it's really a proof of God that these things are meant to be discovered. They're there. And the Word of God, the Bible is the same thing. It's there waiting with these mysteries to be discovered. In Colossians 2, verse 2, Paul wrote, "My goal is that they may have the full riches of complete understanding," Colossians 2, verse 2, "in order that they may know the mystery of God, namely Christ." And in verse 3, "in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge." If somebody came up to you and said, "I have the key to all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge," are you interested? Do you think they go, "I'm busy, I got to eat lunch"? They probably say, "Oh, I got to watch, you know, something on TV, on Netflix. There's something I got to watch tonight. But I'll talk to you tomorrow." No, they would want to know what you're talking about. The most important wisdom that had remained hidden for so long, and it says here in Luke, Jesus thanked God for hiding these great riches from everybody but children, but the mere child. And we heard that in the sermon as well. And he said, he quotes, this is quoting Jesus in Luke, "It pleased God to do so, to reserve it to this perfect moment in time, and then to send it out to people who are simple-minded, people like myself." When Paul wrote to the church of Galatia, he picks up on the story of Hagar and Sarah in Galatians 4. And in Genesis, it was at the very basic Peshat level, right? Is that the very basic? We went through it. And now Paul turns it into a mystery being unfolded. It's a historic narrative about the mothers of Isaac and Ishmael. That's in Genesis. But now there's something more. And now Paul relates it to a parable. He gives it deeper significance. Hagar, he explains, represents the old covenant given to Moses at Mount Sinai. The law, dependent on human nature, depending on us working things out seemingly by ourselves, right? That was a result of it in many ways. Her children were born into slavery. They didn't have hope. And he contrasts that with Sarah. He says Sarah represents the new covenant, which came from, not from Mount Sinai, but from Jerusalem above. He said whose children are the children of promise. They're born into freedom. And not because of their own efforts, not because they were anything great, but by the grace of God. They obeyed through the gift of the Holy Spirit. It's founded on better promises. We have to answer all these questions, and one of the most important questions is destiny. We want to know, where are we going? There are other important questions, too, for another time. But destiny is one of them. Where are we going? And that leads us to number four, the S, PRDS. We've had Peshat, which means simple, Remez, which means hint, Drash, which means mystery, and now we have S, which is Sod, S-O-D. In Hebrew, it means hidden. The meaning is secret. It's concealed. It represents this deepest level of understanding, and Barclay called it the summit of meaning. In Ecclesiastes 3, verse 10, we have really the essence of Sod. I have seen the burden that God has laid upon the sons of men to occupy them. Verse 11, to obsess them, some. He has made everything beautiful in his time. This is a Tyndale phrase. Made everything beautiful in his time. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men. This is also Tyndale, if I recall right. He has set what is hidden, the Hebrews, hidden in the hearts of men. Yet they cannot fathom the work that God has done from the beginning to the end. The questions that we have to answer, as I mentioned too, that namely, what is our destiny? We can spend our entire life trying to figure out, pinpoint it with some exactitude. I'm a child of the 70s, and when I was in college, 1975 rolled around, and I had classmates in college who said, I hope the end comes. We want to go to Petra. Imagine that, the desert. And a friend of mine said, I hope the end time occurs this year because I have no idea what I'm doing when I graduate, which was 3 years hence. Well, we're still here, aren't we? We'd love to pinpoint that and know that. Even though in Matthew 24, verse 36, it says, not even the angels nor the Son, but only the Father knows. that question was going to persist. Imagine that Jesus is ascending and you have one last question to ask him. Now, imagine he's already told you, I'm not going to tell you the answer to that question. Would you ask that same question again? They did. And he said, he gave them the same answer. He said, it's not for you to know times or seasons that the Father has fixed by his own authority. They wanted to know when he was going to establish his kingdom. It's a pertinent question. Well, in Sod includes revelation, and it includes prophecies of the Old Testament. You know, the 70 weeks prophecy of Daniel. We know a lot of that because it took place. But how does it apply today? I remember Bible class at Ambassador trying to sort that out. Thought we had it figured out. There's all kinds of neat things at this level. Numbers. Oh, the symbols of the numbers are so neat. Certain Hebrew and Greek letters. And these can be used to deepen your faith. They really can. They can add a lot to the pizzazz to your study, but you don't want to spend all your time, not like my patient who spends so much of his time in Sod that he's totally, to me, confused. He's sidetracked. It's not where it's not the place where you establish a faith, that's for sure. Hebrews, which is a book I love, and if you read it through Barclay, you will be enchanted and inspired, and it's incredible. But there's a lot of mystery. Even though it has the faith chapter, which is kind of ironic, it's also filled with mystery. It's got more Remez, Drash, and Sod in it than virtually any other book. And that's why it took them about 300 years to decide, to agree, yes, it was the fourth century, they decided this should be a book in the New Testament. They had a greater agreement amongst them, the people making that decision. So you don't want to use Sod to establish your faith. You'll end up with a little living room, and there'll be three or four of you waiting together for the end, you know? And it's neat to fellowship. So sometimes we overlook things that maybe we don't quite agree with, a little bit off, and they're mysteries, and we're willing to overlook some of that. One conclusion, dopamine. I'm going to make a big switch here to dopamine. Dopamine is what we call a feel-good hormone. It's something that gives us pleasure in response to certain things we do. You can make a list. As you click off that list, you release dopamine. It makes you feel good. It can help you with depression. It motivates us to do certain things again and again and again. It's part of the wiring of these rewards that for things that keep us alive. There's pleasure in it because of dopamine, and so we repeat them. We come to naturally do them because of that pleasure that accompanies them. Eating and drinking, some of the basic things we do each day are affected. The hypothalamus releases, the adrenals releases, they play a role in us having thirst. The simple act of drinking water causes dopamine to be released. It does so because it saves your life. You might want to do that again before it's all said and done, right? I want to repeat that. Drinking, swallowing, just swallowing causes dopamine to be released. And when it reaches your brain, remember I said earlier that even before it ever gets absorbed, you stop drinking, right? Before the body has a way of saying, well, now you've changed the balance or the imbalance. So this wonderful dopamine, when it reaches our brain, and this lamina terminalis says, hey, it's time to release more dopamine. Actually, you get more dopamine after it gets to your brain. So the body subconsciously notices and will repeat, will encourage us to repeat that at very frequent intervals. Well, when David looked towards Jerusalem, the only metaphor that he could come up with that seemed appropriate for his desire to be back in the temple in God's presence was thirst. Thirst that was born in a very dry and thirsty land. John 7, verse 37 through 38, I'm wrapping it up. Jesus stood in the temple where David so much wanted to be. And he too was being hunted. They were looking for him. This was during the holy days, the tabernacles. The last great day, they think. It said the chief priest, it says, had sent officers to take him. So he was under certain, similar circumstances to David. And he said in a very loud voice, let anyone who is thirsty, anyone who deeply desires, come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, and he's quoting, it's a multitude of verses from the Old Testament about thirst and drink, and one of them is a proverb by David's own son that he's quoting. Rivers of living water will flow from within them out of their heart. To search and to find is the honor of kings. Isn't that wonderful? But it's also the honor of those known as the privileged ones, the ones who find God in a dry and thirsty land.